The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
There's a famous teaching that the Buddha gave in the last months of his life, where he says, be a light unto yourself. And that's a very evocative statement, be a light unto yourself. It happens that the word for light in Pali is dipa, D-I-P-A, and it could also mean island, be an island unto yourself. And both words are kind of evocative. I like the word light, be your own light. And I think that in a part what this practice we're doing here is to discover how to be a light unto ourselves, to kind of turn on the light. So that we have the light. And what happens when you have light is you can see. When you're in the dark, you can't see. And so the task of mindfulness is to be able to see clearly and to somehow extinguish the darkness that we somehow live in, where we don't see properly, and then with the light, see properly what's going on here. And sometimes the light, our light dawns slowly, slowly, slowly gets lighter. And sometimes it's like turning on the light and the darkness vanishes immediately. Being a light unto yourself means that we don't look externally for a light or externally for a refuge. Something external which is going to be our savior, but really we find something in ourselves, in our own hearts. And I think the contemplative life, this mindfulness life, is a beautiful process of discovering something quite beautiful that we all have, a capacity for awareness, for seeing clearly, and so to be a light unto yourself. So this teaching where the Buddha gave this is an interesting kind of passage. And I thought I would read it to you and talk about it a little bit. And so again, so the Buddha was just near the end of his life. He's an old man. He's about 80, 81 years old. And my kind of assumption, not having been there, is that when you were 80 in the year 500 BC, you were a lot older than you are when you're 80 nowadays. You know, they didn't have a lot of the same kind of care that they have these days. And illnesses come in, and there's, you know, you didn't have palliative care when you were dying, you know. You had pain. There's no real pain medication. And so it was probably, you know, fairly challenging to be an old man. And you hear some of this in the story for the Buddha. So the Buddha, it was what was called the rains retreat, the last rains of his life, the last 3 months where he stays put in one place. And during the rains, the Buddha was attacked by a severe sickness with sharp pains as if he were about to die. So that's not, you know, maybe it was hagiography, maybe they were kind of building it up, saying he was much, much more painful than he really was. But I think it's unlikely. I mean, it's, you know, illnesses can hurt a lot. And if you don't have pain medication, it's pretty bad. Sharp pains as if he were about to die. But he endured all this mindfully, clearly aware and without complaining. He thought, it is not fitting that I should die without addressing my followers and taking leave of the order of monks. I must hold this disease in check by energy and apply myself to the force of life. He did so, and the disease abated. So here is a man, an old man, 80 years old man, tremendous pain, he's sick, seemingly at the edge of death, and he makes this resolution, this resolve, to somehow rally his forces to stay alive for a little bit longer. So he can kind of make his final addressing, kind of final, have a final instructions or address his students one last time. Then, having recovered from his sickness, as soon as he felt better, he went outside, sat on a prepared seat in front of his dwelling. Then the Venerable Ananda came to him, saluted him, sat down to one side and said, Lord, I have seen the Buddha in comfort, and I've seen the Buddha patient. I've seen the Buddha's patient enduring, and my body was like a drunkard's. I lost my bearings, and things were unclear to me because of the Buddha's sickness. The only thing that was of some comfort to me was the thought, the Buddha will not die until he has made some statement about the order of monks. So Ananda was, for 20 years, Ananda was his kind of right-hand attendant, traveled around with him, knew him very well, they're very close, they actually were cousins also. But Ananda was not enlightened. Even though he spent so much time with the Buddha, so here he describes himself being quite distressed at the prospect of his teacher dying. And his body was like a drunkard. I lost my bearings. And the Buddha replied, but Ananda, what does the order of monks expect of me? I have taught the Dharma, Ananda, making no inner or outer distinction in teachings, no distinction between what's hidden and exposed. What it means that he said it all. He had no hidden teachings. There's no last hidden teachings like, now, finally, he's about to die. He's finally going to give you, everybody's waiting for the secret, right? So no secrets. I've explained it all. I've said it all. It's all very public. It's upfront. It's not esoteric. Not a hidden teaching. The Buddha has no teacher's fist in respect to doctrines. Teacher fist means you hide the teachings in the fist. You don't really show everything. So the idea in Buddhism, the Buddha taught with an open hand. And this idea of an open hand, the teachings, the practices are offered freely and openly to everyone, anybody who wants it. And it's just there for people to use. But the trick is, it's there for people to use. It's up to you to use them, not the Buddha. Buddha's not going to use it for you. He can just have his open hand with the teachings. And then the Buddha continued, if there is anyone who thinks, I shall take charge of the order. So here he's dying, right? So he says, anybody thinks, I should take charge of the order, or the order should refer to me, let him make some statement like that if he wants. But the Tathagata, the Buddha, me, does not think in such terms. So here he's saying he doesn't think of himself as the leader. He was a person in charge of this community of people. And I think this is quite a statement to make at the end of his life. He was, in many ways, the leader of the community, and he set the rules for it all. But here, as he's dying, he's not claiming that he's the leader who's in charge anymore. And in fact, he refused to appoint a successor. This idea, you're not looking externally to somebody who's going to be your leader, because you're supposed to be a light unto yourself. So then, Ananda, said the Buddha, I am now old, worn out, one who has traversed life's paths. I've reached the end of life. I've reached the term of life, which is 80. Just as an old cart is made to go by being held together by straps, so the Tathagata's body is kept going by being strapped up. It's only when the Tathagata, the Buddha, withdraws his attention from outward signs and by the cessation of certain feelings enters into the concentration that his body knows comfort. So, none of you are held together by straps yet, some of you who are getting older can maybe well imagine things are not working the way they used to work and limping along and you know, your teeth are not the same what they used to be, and your eyesight is not... My wife, who's in her late 40s, is quite surprised by what's happening with her eyes. And she's struggling to figure out this thing with the what to do with the glasses and where are they and when to use them, when not to use them. And they didn't have glasses back then, but they didn't read either. So there's an old cart held together by straps. That's quite, you know, Buddha's describing his own experience. You know, we have, usually, religions like to depict their founders in glorious terms. And, we kind of do it here. We have this beautiful statue of the Buddha here. He's, probably he's in his 30s, upright, noble, healthy, and everything. And, not that often they depict the Buddha as this old, bent-over guy with held together by straps, you know, limping along, barely alive, sick. He describes himself, one of the suttas, as being bent over, all wrinkled. Isn't that great? And in case you thought that if you could only get enlightened, then you can live in wonderful, enlightened retirement, and you wouldn't even, need a facelift because everything will be taken care of. But no, even when you're enlightened, the body takes its course. The body unfolds. It gets sick and old and the struggles of that. And again, I'm repeating myself, but I'm kind of touched by the idea that they didn't have all the medical care and support that people here, at least in California, so many people here, not everyone, can avail themselves of or get. So it's only when he gets into deep meditation, concentration, that he gets some relief from his pains and his difficulties. And that's, I think, something really special, that if you've cultivated your meditation practice when you have a chance, it can perhaps become a refuge at a time when it's really needed. And it can help you deal with pain, deal with all kinds of problems that might arise. And there's no guarantee that medicine is going to have help for you. No guarantee that there's going to be palliative care for you. So he talks about how he's old, and just through meditation can he get some relief from his pain. Therefore, the Buddha continued, you should live as lights unto yourselves, being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge, with the Dharma as a light, with the Dharma as your refuge, with no other refuge. So, yourself as your own refuge. Sometimes in Theravada Buddhism, a lot of times we talk about the three refuges, and people take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. But there's also a fourth refuge, and remarkably, that refuge is you. But are you worthy of refuge at this point? Are you really capable of being finding inside of yourself a repository of truth and strength and compassion and wisdom that can carry you through great challenges that might come across in your life? Hopefully that's the case, and because it's certainly a potential we all have. The function of the practice that Buddha taught is a practice that helps make us a refuge. We help find ourselves the strength, the peace, the compassion, the wisdom, so that with whatever life brings us, we can meet it with some balance, with equanimity, with peace, so we don't drown. And this is where the idea of the island instead of the light, be an island unto yourself. Island is a place where you're safe. You know, but when there's a flood, go to the island, and hopefully be safe. So therefore, you should live as lights unto yourselves, being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge, with the Dharma as a light, with the Dharma as your refuge, with no other refuge. And how does a person live as a light unto oneself? Here, Ananda, a person abides contemplating the body as body, earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, and having put away all hankerings and fretting for the world, and likewise with regard to feelings, mind, and mind objects. That ananda is how a person lives as a light unto oneself, with no other refuge. And those who now in my time, or afterwards, who live thus, they will attain the highest, if they want to train, if they want to do the training, the work, the study. So here, become a light unto yourself, and then he's going to tell you how to do that. And remarkably, he says the four foundations of mindfulness, which is the core teaching of mindfulness that we do here. Mindfulness of your body, to somehow center yourself in your body and know how to be present for your body in and of itself, to be aware of your feelings and be centered in them in and of themselves, and then your mind states and what's called, here he calls it mind objects, or your the dhammas, the mental processes that go on inside of us, to really see clearly. And the expression, which can be translated as the body in and of itself, the mind in and of itself, means to be present for it without the added interpretations and commentary and reactions that's also common to have. We often have stories, we add things on top of it. We don't just see our body, we see our body in light of our self-image or how we think it should be or what our society tells us what a body should be. And there's a whole slew of stories and ideas we make up. It's quite something to be alive, to be present in the face of some real big challenges. The Buddha here, challenge of death, to be present and not have a story about what's happening, where it's going, what's next, what's happening tomorrow. And there's something about, it's very poignant, very powerful, about being present here and knowing how to be present here for just this as it is, just our immediate experience of body, of feelings, of mind, and to just feel it and to feel the vibrancy of the fullness of it and the freedom that's possible here, and not let the mind tip over into its story making, into its imagination, into its judgments, into its fears, into its memories of everything, but just here. And this is a fantastic capacity to have when it's the stories, interpretations, and ideas we make that get us to suffer, get us into trouble. So to be a light unto ourselves is to be mindful of what's happening in here in the present moment as it's happening in a vivid and clear way. That's where the light is. One of the things you'll see, if you have that kind of presence, you'll see the mind beginning to make stories, interpretations. So you see the mind producing fear or aversion. And to see it occurring in the present moment and not falling into it, not being swept up into it, but just to see it, stay present, to be mindful of it, is a place of freedom. So, you know, you see the projections into the future, you see the holding on to the past beginning to happen, and you stay present here. And that presence, clearly seeing the arising of something and the passing away of it, clearly seeing ourselves being present and aware of it, is sometimes described as turning on the light and keeping the light on. When we tip over and fall into the story-making mind, the judging mind, the past and the future ideas we have, the imagination, some people report that it's kind of like things get darkened, a darkening, a closing down, a constriction that happens. When we come back to being mindful and awake, it's like the light goes on again. There's this clarity or there's openness or translucency that can happen in the mind. And there is a possibility of freedom. So to be a light unto yourself. be a refuge unto yourself, is one of the great powerful pointers or teachers of this teachings of this tradition that we're in. And it's not meant to be a selfish teaching or a self-centered teaching, to be a light unto yourself. It isn't that you're like the, you know, the best around. But rather, it's the opposite, because the very movement to be self-centered or selfish, with this focus on being a light on yourself, that itself is a darkening. That itself involves suffering and narrowing. It's tipping over and falling into one of the stories we make up. And if we can keep the light on, you can't be selfish. You'll be open and you'll see. And in the light, it's my confidence and my experience my confidence that when your light is turned on, when you're awake and present, the very best qualities of who you are, whatever your good qualities might be, have a chance to shine forth. So I'll end with the analogy that I like, of the greenhouse analogy. If a greenhouse has curtains and it covers the glass so no light comes in, and it's, you know, kind of hot and humid in there and dark, all the mold grows, and it just kind of gets really disgusting. But if you pull the curtains and let the light come in, then that disgusting slime and stuff dries out, and the plants that are in there, the beautiful plants, the orchards or orchids or whatever, they can grow and bloom. So when our curtains are drawn and we live in the dark, then our slime, our greed, our hate, our aversion, our fear can start kind of, you know, fermenting or something. And then, but turn on the light, and then the flowers can grow. So let your flowers grow. So those are my thoughts today. And I think we have about 20 minutes, 15 minutes. If any of you would like to ask any questions or make some comments or talk about something. Right behind you is a mic.
I read today, and I've been, it sort of represents what you said about the greenhouse, is that I think of myself as a circle. And if people look at me, they see a circle, and we rarely see a hole in the wall. And I think what I've been struggling with is what's inside the circle, which is my own stories, as well as being impacted by the wall, like the lines of the circle are like your blanket. So I've been struggling with, I mean, I have my own internal triggers where that mold grows, but I also, given that I am also really connected to my environment, the people in it, I find myself being blanketed, and I struggle with feeling and trusting that expansive state and not going into protective mode.
Great, beautiful. So you struggle with that. It's good that you know that you're struggling. One of the great things, I think, is not succeeding, but is practicing. It's nice to succeed in practice, but it's really significant to have a practice and to know there's a practice and have the strength and the courage to keep doing it even when it's difficult. And in some ways, that's really where the heart and the growth of the practice is in the doing, in the trying and the efforting and hanging in there and resolve. And take refuge in that. And if people keep looking at your mold, remind yourself that it's just more fodder for your practice to do your best. And they might see the mold, but no one puts the blankets over your greenhouse except for you. So if they might try to bring, they might bring you blankets, lots of blankets, but you're the one who picks them up. So you might look at that a little bit and see when people come to you with projections and ideas, you might look at, see how you react to that, what you do, And if you're getting dark, it's because of something you're doing. Behind you there.
I was wondering if you could help me better understand how to, I don't want to say plan for a future, or if you're in, whether it's a work relationship or an intimate relationship, planning together and communicating how that can be different, or is it different than having a story?
Can
you help me understand that better?
Yeah, maybe there's no sharp line between stories and plans, but having stories is an important part of life. I wouldn't want to have a life with no stories. And it doesn't make sense to have a life without, you know. I mean, if you know you're dying, maybe there's not a lot of planning that makes sense anymore. But planning is an important part of life as well. So how do we do it wisely is the question. And so to understand that, we have to understand what it's like to do it unwisely. So what it's like to get caught in it and lost in it and reactive to it. So we study ourselves to see how our mind works, and we see what it's like to get lost. When you sit down to meditate, for example, can you let go of your concern with planning? Can you let go of the stories you have? Because if you can let go of it, then when you need to look at it, you can look at it with fresh eyes. But if you when you meditate and it keeps churning and churning and churning, it probably indicates you're caught by it. Sitting down with someone you have to talk to and make a plan about the future it could be a very wise thing to do. And there are times when that's appropriate. And then it helps if you stay present while you do it. Planning about the future only occurs in the present. And so if you're clearly aware this is what's happening in the present, and know what you're feeling, know what's going on in your body, and are really present for the process of planning, you're less likely to get in trouble than if you get lost into the image of the future. So does that speak to you, or is that not quite to the point? Do you find it confusing? You want to ask something else, or something related, or another way? Yes, of course. Plan. Plan another answer question. Yes, and can you pass the mic back to the back of the...
Have you ever thought about how you would explain to someone from a theistic background how they might be a light unto themselves?
God's done his part, now it's our turn.
That was easy.
Are you satisfied?
Very.
Very, wow. You have another mic on this side?
Hi, I'm relatively new to all this, and you said there were four things. I think you said Buddha, Dharma, something, and light.
Yeah, so one of the things I talked about is there's the refuges. It's called what we take refuge in, or what we kind of... things that we turn towards to support us or orient us for finding our practice, our life. And classically, there's a list of three refuges, or sometimes called the three treasures. They're the Buddha, who is the person who kind of discovered this particular practice and path for us. It also refers to that capacity for us to be Buddhas, us to be awake. The awakening. Buddha means awakening. And then the Dharma means the teachings that he taught, but it also means the practices and inner processes that lead to freedom, to liberation. So we orient ourselves towards that. We use that to support. And the third is the sangha, which is community of other people who practice with us, because we don't do it alone. It's really supportive to have other people and who share what we're doing and help us and support us along the way. In particular, those people who have tasted, who have had witnessed or had some experience of real freedom, who really know that the real, genuine, deep spiritual freedom is possible. Those are people in particular can be very supportive for us because they know where it's all going. So those are called the three refuges. And then in our tradition, sometimes we talk, say, there's a fourth, and that's ourselves. Take refuge in ourselves. Does that make sense? You pass them.
I wonder if you could speak a little bit more about the topic of planning. It's one that I struggle with a lot, to try to be present in the present moment, and also be a responsible parent for my children and think about their future, my future, without necessarily being attached to those plans. But it's something that I really struggle with. I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I think that some things that we do in our lives, certain in order to do them responsibly, require planning. We can't just leave things to chance and just a conversation I had with my wife earlier today was had to do with, like, you know, when there's school vacations, you know, we just, doesn't make sense. We're having one coming up, right? It's not going to work if we don't plan. I mean, it could work, but what's going to work? I mean, something's going to work. We'll get through it, I'm sure. But you know, if we don't have some kind of plan of what these kids are going to do during the vacation, you know, I don't think it's going to be that pretty. So, but anyway, many things in life require planning. It's a responsible life requires some degree of planning. Some people are neurotic planners because they're motivated by fear or motivated by greed or something, and they're kind of caught in the cycles of planning. But how do we plan wisely? So one thing that's useful, I think, is to set aside time. That's where you're intentionally going to do. So the mind knows, you know, that Saturday evening you're going to sit down and you're going to sit down and actually talk and make plans. Sometimes if the mind knows that there's a designated time to do something, then it has the worrying that keeps it going and wondering, you know, should I do it? When should I do it? It keeps it going. Maybe it can be put to rest a little bit. And so making time. Some people can find it useful to plan very conscientiously or carefully, go for a walk or journal or something, and just write down ideas and brainstorm and really take it on wholeheartedly, not just casually in something. Or talk to a friend or sit down and actually go back and forth and brainstorm. So it's very intentional and clear. Is helpful. And then the mindfulness practice is to come back and always be mindful of the body. So what's going on in your body when you're planning? Has your body collapsed? You know, oh, this is too hard. You know, and you're kind of like your hands and your head and your head's in your lap and, oh, it's so hard. That's good information to have, to know that your body's posture has changed. Is that the posture you want to plan in? And probably not. You're not much of a refuge for yourself in that kind of collapsed posture. So, you know, just in an ordinary way, sit up straight. And then your posture becomes a little bit more support. What are you feeling? What are you, you know, is there a lot of fear going on? And if there is a lot of fear going on connected with the planning, maybe there's something deeper that needs to be looked at. Maybe it's not the time to make plans. Maybe you need to understand what the fear is about and really understand. Do you have all the information you need to make good plans? And sometimes it's impossible to get all of it. It's not the nature of life, but sometimes maybe you can do some research or talk to people who know. And so you have more ideas. And I know that for parents, like for me, it's been very helpful to talk to other parents, to realize that to learn from what other parents experience. Sometimes I learn that they have the same challenges as we do, and, oh, my kid's normal. I thought he was a different species. So planning I have this budding teen at home, and I just talked to one of my oldest friends, and has a son exactly the same age, and turns out I have it easy. That's not what I thought in comparison, but so I don't know. So I think doing it intentionally and then staying present for the process of planning. And then if there's a lot of unnecessary or difficult feelings connected to it, then you have to do some inner work to look and understand that and try to clarify it and free it up. So behind you.
Came in late, but just the comment about the lamp. Saying came to me. It's some Hindu master. And he said, light your own lamp. No one can give you salvation.
Yep, thank you. So I was thinking of this topic of the light for two reasons today. One is because of the time of year. But also, there's a few other reasons. One is that today I had a meeting with some of the senior Buddhist teachers in the Bay Area. And they're senior, right? And beautiful people. But the issues of age and aging and body are as relevant for them as any person who's getting older. But you could see their light was on. As I talked about, it was quite beautiful. And I felt these people, these men and women that I met are bright lights for the Bay Area. Beautiful people, beautiful teachers, and I was inspired by their light. And then also because yesterday here at IMC we had a presentation, community meeting, to talk about the retreat center that we're going to buy down in Scotts Valley. And at least for me, that's a bright light. The idea to have this beautiful light for our community, for our society. A retreat center is a place where we turn on lots of lights. So hopefully we'll have one for all of you. And probably all of your lights are on somewhat, but the retreat center will turn it on bright. So thank you so much for